17 years ago this morning, after a brief April shower, the sun broke through just in time to greet almost 250 people who were meeting for the first time to become University Congregational Church. It seemed a good omen after some difficult times, so we sang "Morning Has Broken" and hoped for a bright future together. Although the truth is that not one of us could even imagine worshiping someday in a place as beautiful as this one. In that way, and in many others, we have been singularly blessed. But the years take their toll, and some of the dear faces present on that first joyous morning are missing. So I'm sure that after a while, our birthday will no longer be as important as it still is for those of us who have marked it over the years with a special service of Holy Communion. I have tried all sorts of ways of setting a mood for our observance of this sacred ritual, from heavy surveys of its theology and its complex history, to simple stories of how people like ourselves have found new ways to fill it with meaning. My approach this morning will be different from anything you might expect. So personal a reminiscence, and so indirect at first, that you will wonder how it can ever find its way back to getting ourselves ready for communion. But I promise that it will. What I'd like to do is talk about how we know things, how some things register in the mind as knowledge, and how others register in the heart and become part of our emotional landscape. The examples I've chosen to illustrate this mental dichotomy are taken from a single hour of a single day in the life I spend as a student. And as strange as all my starts and stops during that hour of research may sound to you, I confess that they're fairly typical of my study patterns. You may decide after you hear them that what I need most is long-time therapy, but I hope you'll humor me for a few minutes as I try to make the point of this sermon. It is a perfectly ordinary day, and I'm in my study wondering what title to give a bulletin list of sermons for the following month. Hoping they will be a feast and not a fast, and knowing they will be delivered on the 10th month of the year, the German word Oktoberfest suddenly comes to mind. One of those dozens of trivial choices we make every day. It was different for me that day only because once I had made it, I decided I would like to pause and refresh my memory about the details of that famous German festival, not only for the pure pleasure of doing it, but to be properly primed when the inevitable curious parishioner came up afterwards to say, "I'm going to be in Germany next fall. Tell me more about this Oktoberfest." So I reached for the closest resource book, and as my eyes ran down the page toward the words beginning with O-K, I was stopped by the word O-K-I-E, Okie. Most of you would not have felt any compulsion to stop and read that definition, but I grew up in Oklahoma, and the guy from Chicago who married my only sister called her with great affection through all their years together by the nickname Okie. On the particular day we're talking about, when I came across her nickname in search of something else, she had already been gone from his life and mine for many years. So I was prompted to check my emotional response to that word against the kind of factual knowledge printed in a reference work. I read first that the word Oki is an insulting name for people who live on the Japanese island of Okinawa, which was news to me. And then I read a definition closer to home, that the word Oki was once used to name a migrant worker from Oklahoma. My critical monitor, my mind, told me that the second definition was partly wrong, because although the Depression-era Okies took their name from Oklahoma, they did not all originate in that state. Headed with desperate hope toward the rich valleys of California, they came from several other states as well, from Dust Bowl farms in Arkansas and Texas, New Mexico and Arizona, even from southern Kansas. But this is information that runs around inside the head. If you want the other kind of knowledge, the kind that touches the heart, you would have had to know those frightened people. Or failing that, you would have to read with a keen imagination The Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck's epic novel of their migration. Read it so feelingly that you identify with Ma Jode, the indomitable matriarch who holds her family together, with her ex-convict son, Tom, who in that long, weary exodus finds a new life, and with Jim Casey, the cynical country preacher who learns on the journey what it means to love. Once identify with those characters and others in the novel, and the word Oki will never mean just what you find in a dictionary. You will have heart knowledge. If you've forgotten now how we got where we are at this moment, I remind you that I am still up in my study looking for more information about the word Oktoberfest, except that I've been stopped by the word Oki and the difference once again between fact and feelings. But I still need to reach the word I wanted in the first place, so I move on, only to find when I get there that the definition is too skimpy. So I get up, walk downstairs to shelves of books in another room, and pull out a novel by Thomas Wolfe called The Web and the Rock, so I can reread the chapter where he describes what the famous autumn fair in Munich is like. I learn again the historical facts, but caught up in the mastery of his poetic language, I begin to know by imagination and emotion. He makes me smell the great hall packed with sweating, overweight bodies, makes me hear the sullen roar of the crowd, makes me taste the dark, bitter October beer. I am feeling something now, not just reading a dry definition, and emotion drives me to want to know more, to know how the great Germanic festival got started. So I head for some other shelves where the 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica rest in dark blue dignity, open the one that will have entries under OK, and all of a sudden, my eyes fall on the name of a small town called Okmulgee, Oklahoma. I'm surprised, and I'm rather glad that the people who pay my salary don't know how I work, because that little town didn't even make it into the 20-volume American encyclopedia called World Book. So what was the name of my birthplace doing in that awesome British collection of important information? One more digression, and as it turns out, one more chance to ponder the difference between facts and feeling. So while my interrupted labors wait a little longer, I read eagerly the paragraph about Okmulgee. Pure information. A city of eastern Oklahoma, USA, on Federal Highway 75 and the Frisco and Okmulgee Northern Railroad, population 17,430, 78% white and 19% Negroes. Of the time when I was a child, Britannica said, it is the center of one of the great oil-producing regions of the world. Within an area of 2,000 square miles are some 6,000 producing wells, which supply 16% of the total output of the United States. Fact piled upon fact. I grew up seeing those wells, but we didn't own one, so the knowledge never really touched my emotional life. But as Britannica goes on to talk about oil and gas, all of a sudden I begin to smell the old Phillips 66 refinery, which was never completely out of anybody's mind in my childhood, because so many fathers and sons worked there, and because the danger of a fatal explosion was something we lived with every day. And standing there in the living room, by the bookcase, the dry words began to pass from fact to feelings. I am remembering with the heart. And it happens even more intensely as I read the final entry in that dry, dusty description. In a square in the heart of the city stands the council house, which was the capital of the Creek Indian Nation for half a century. There it is again, just a bare piece of information, unless emotion and memory transform it. But they do, because of my childhood experience with that courthouse square. On Saturdays, before the afternoon movie started at the Orpheum Theater, I would roam the Creek Indian Museum, where I first got acquainted with arrowheads and pottery, beaded deerskin and moccasins. My nose wrinkles at the musty smell of those museum rooms. And imagination, heightened now, replays those Saturday nights through the long Oklahoma summers when my sister and I would play in that square until my father closed his nearby furniture store at 10 o'clock. And now, the knowledge of the heart strikes even deeper because I see my sister again and hear her voice. I relive a certain Saturday night when she fails in the dim light to see a piece of barbed wire a workman has left strung up, does not notice in time this younger, beloved sister who could run like the wind, and running in our game of tag, rips her arm open so that for the rest of her life there will be an ugly scar to link the two of us with that night and with our happy childhood together. Just a few lines of neutral description in dictionaries and encyclopedias, and by an act of imagination, part of my life passes before my eyes. Now, let's relate all of this to what we're doing this morning. You can go downstairs to our church library and read a long theological essay about communion, Mass, the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, whatever your church calls it. You can catalog more facts than I could ever wish to unload in a single sermon, but facts only make a difference to character when they slip from the head to the heart. Is it possible to make that happen with communion before we share it this morning? A little while ago, you heard Leon Green read our scripture text from the Gospel of Luke, with its brief description of what the church has ever since understood to be the institution of the Lord's Supper. I invite you now to go behind the factual statements and imagine, recreate with imagination, a desperately tired and worried man climbing the stairs to an upper room in Jerusalem with a few of his friends to eat a simple meal by candlelight. A crusty loaf of bread, a goatskin bag full of cheap wine. There is tension in the room, fear of the unknown, a brooding sense that something dear to all of them is coming to an end. Somewhere else in the city, in a Roman barracks, a young soldier may be finding it hard to sleep because he keeps seeing the agonies of death by crucifixion, which he has to inflict in the morning. And inside the room, a tiny little clink of silver in the pocket of Judas when he moves, and a look on the face of Jesus which his friends have not seen before. So after a bit, he picks up a piece of bread, looks at it thoughtfully, and says, "This is my body, broken for you." There is no proof that they understand exactly what he means, but they accept his invitation to join him also in drinking the dark red wine, which looks a little like the blood he will spill in a few more hours. And in the morning, one of the crosses on a nearby hill takes away a life so full of love it has been honored ever since. A few days later, according to the same writer, two of the followers of Jesus are walking along a dusty road when a stranger joins them. The three men talk of odd rumors flying about, and as evening falls, the two disciples invite the stranger to join them for supper. As they eat, he takes a loaf, blesses it, and breaks it, and their eyes, we are told, are opened. "It is he," they whisper, and then he vanishes. If it comforts you to take that story quite literally, then by all means do so. But know that many devout Bible students take it as one of the most beautiful little parables ever created. A way of saying to us that wherever we are, thinking of him and in his name serving others, he will be there in some way present. We will see him, of course, not with the eyes we use to read a book, but with the eyes of the heart. We are going to try now to feel what it was like on that last night when God's child looked at the broken bread and the red wine and found in them symbols of his life and love. If you can be truly glad for both, and if you're willing to use the high gift of imagination, we invite you now to transform what happens in the next few moments into a true communion with the Spirit of Him in whose name we are together in this room.